Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever.
Welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. I have with me, I think, someone who's doing really, really important and cutting-edge work right now. It's Dr. Brendan McQuaid, and he's been working on, I think, something that is so important, which is looking at the actual ways in which discourses and policies of decarceration represents a new form of social regulation and control, one that is both smart, uses real-time tracking, and is meant to be empowering, but actually helps support the very capitalist and, I would say, kind of increasingly authoritarian status quo that it's meant to be resisting. So, Brendan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Peter.
So, like I said, I mean, you've been working on these issues and looking at them from a variety of different perspectives, but how did you get into this? I mean, I always ask the guests this, but I think I'm particularly interested in it because this requires such a wide range of interest, and your book on this is so fantastic in that it's simultaneously kind of political economy, it's policy studies, it's theoretical and critical about power. So what is your background and what inspired you to do the work that you do?
Well, I guess I'll start with what inspired me to get started. So, you know, I studied these interagency intelligence hubs under the Department of Homeland Security in the United States that called fusion centers. And they're, you know, a pretty obscure thing. So what brought me to them? So I'm 35, and when I was in high school, I kind of watched with great interest first the George W. Bush administration kind of steal the 2000 election, and then, you know, 9/11 and, the war on terror get rolled out. And, I was involved in the anti-war movement, and I became particularly interested in my the background of my congressman at the time, who was Rob Simmons, a Republican representing 2nd District in Connecticut. He was a military intelligence and CIA veteran in the Vietnam War, who literally ran a interrogation center and a paramilitary death squad, if you will, during the war. So he became a target of the anti-war movement in the mid-aughts. Right? I became interested in him, interested in his career in a more academic sense, because, he was also, not only had he had this terrifying and interesting background, he also was one of the congressional architects of Homeland Security. And he was specifically involved in setting up these network of fusion centers, which look a lot like the intelligence systems put in place to coordinate counterinsurgency operations, and it's not just in Vietnam, it's, a much more general model. So I did research on this for my senior thesis as an undergrad. I tried to freelance my way into journalism. I gave up on that ambition and went to grad school. I went to grad school at Binghamton University in the SUNY system, the State University of New York. And Binghamton University is known, the sociology department is known for what's called world systems analysis, which is a particular brand of historical sociology that looks at, long-term, large-scale social change. So, I was reading stuff in grad school, about the the development of historical capitalism over the long durée. Most of my friends in, in grad school were writing dissertations about, the integration of the Ottoman Empire into the world market, or, how the United States went from what we call a semi-peripheral to a core nation. Meanwhile, I was doing essentially a police ethnography. And I think having this, large scale structural understanding of the world while doing a micro study in institutional ethnography gave me kind of a unique perspective and kind of helped me get out of the echo chamber that, you see in a lot of critical criminology or surveillance studies, where, it's kind of people saying the same things over and over again about different subjects. And I think, bringing a different theoretical perspective kind of led me to make a different type of argument.
No, I think that's so interesting. And I think it also, and one of the things that we can talk about is how your work shows in a very, very structural way how insatiable and opportunistic capitalism is as a development system, right? And I think that drives to the next question, which is so much of the current critique is against, and understandably so, mass incarceration, which I think is very important. But you've really focused on the dangers of what you call, and others have called, but mass surveillance. And it's a bit different than the 1984 kind of George Orwell notion of, being totally watched all the time. It's a new kind of 21st century form of, quote unquote, smart tracking. So what is this mass surveillance, and how do you see it related to previous forms of mass incarceration and as a new means of social regulation?
Yeah, well, I'm happy you asked the question that way, because the key concept for me is really social regulation, or even more specifically, what some people call pacification. So when you mentioned capitalism being insatiable, right? The tradition that's so influential to me, world systems analysis, kind of bothered a lot of Marxists by defining capitalism not in terms of, necessarily the labor capital relation, but as a system dedicated towards the infinite and endless accumulation of capital. And, in the world systems tradition, this allows, this is essential to be able to talk about, the division of labor on the world scale, where capital, wage labor is very important, but so is, forced labor, so is debt peonage, so is petty commodity production. All these things, in different periods of historical capitalism have been articulated under capital, right? So capital organizes all forms of labor control. So why am I talking about this, right? I'm talking about this because not only does capitalism organize all forms of labor control, it also constantly destroys, reorganizes them, right? So this is, the famous lines from Marx's manifesto, all that is solid melts to air, right? So capitalism is an order of endless insecurity that necessarily demands a politics of security. So to understand this, right, and not get trapped, into security discourse, a group of scholars that I'm affiliated with, the Anti-Security Collective, has reappropriated this idea of pacification as a from military jargon to be a critical concept to talk about the systemic processes of capitalist order making. So with all that said, let's talk about mass incarceration, right? People, if you are a casual consumer of progressive media in the US or in the Anglo world, you may have a understanding that, well, mass incarceration is this continuation of Jim Crow, it's this system of racial domination, it's related to the drug war and these tough on crime politics that came that that Nixon first articulated and really, you know, became dominant with Reagan, right? And all of that is true, but it's missing something critical, right? Mass incarceration isn't just about politics. It isn't just about punishing, you know, the racial other, right? It's also a mode of social regulation. It's a pacification project. It's a way of managing the insecurities produced by capital accumulation. So here I build off of, you know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work, Golden Gulag, who I think, you know, got it absolutely right when she argued that, you know, this massive prison boom that happened in the United States in the 80s and 90s was the way that, you know, that the United States managed the transition from a, you know, industrial economy to a post-industrial service-based economy. So what is mass incarceration? It's a as a mode of labor regulation. It's a way to warehouse workers that no longer have a place in the economy, are no longer valued as, you know, workers, consumers, or citizens, right? So mass incarceration is a way of taking, you know, surplus populations that would be a problem to the state because they would be potentially rebellious or disorderly, and turning them perversely into an asset that the state can manage and, you know, create markets around, right? So, you know, all the market, you know, not the prison is slavery argument in a direct and simple way, but all the markets created, you know, by mass incarceration, the building, the provisioning, the staffing of the prison, right? All of that turns workers that were excluded from the economy, you know, into perversely a resource. So that's the, you know, that's the radical critique of mass incarceration. Now, what I argue in my book is that, you know, mass incarceration is over, it's ending, right? Mass incarceration was arose to manage this big world economic transformation, right? And that transformation is complete. We live in a, you know, a quote unquote globalized world. That's over, right? Neoliberalism is here. As a profit fix, I kind of follow this Marxist economist, Robert Michaels, who says, you know, neoliberalism as a profit fix has been done since the Asian crisis, since 1998. And now we're in a long depression, right? So, you know, what I'm trying to explain in my book is like, well, if this economic order that, you know, started to come to being in the late 60s and early 70s became kind of irreversible and fully consolidated in the 1980s, if that's actually in decline, right, then what comes next? And, you know, this is the question I ended up at trying to understand fusion centers, because when you look at, you know, what's going on in the U.S., prison populations have been declining for a decade nationwide, down 9% from 2010, right? And there's certain state governments have had, you know, massive reductions, right? But we haven't had a return to a more rehabilitative, you know, rehabilitative social policy. We don't have decarceration happening and huge investments in public health and education and welfare and et cetera. What we're having instead is decarceration and, you know, the same old in social policy. So what's happening to manage those unruly surplus populations that would be, you know, disorderly and potentially rebellious, right? And the answer I offer in my book is, you know, we're moving from a mass incarceration to a more police and surveillance intensive form of pacification or social regulation. And, you know, we should talk about that as mass supervision. And the centerpiece of that to me is police surveillance, right? If you look at the literature on fusion centers, they're all concerned with counterterrorism, they're concerned with civil liberties protection. They miss this wider connection to, you know, the carceral state, to mass incarceration, to longer trajectories of state formation. They miss the link to, they largely miss the link to questions of labor control. And then when you bring all this in, you see the, you know, the full significance. because the stuff that's happening at fusion centers, you know, they call it intelligence fusion, but data fusion happens across all industries, right? And it's a new technique of administration. It's one that's, you know, novel and different than what came before it, right? And it demands an explanation. And the explanation that I offer essentially is that neoliberalism is over. We're entering a new, you know, more predatory, exclusionary mode of capitalism. And in the way that this, the greater insecurities of this period of capitalism are being managed is through, you know, mass surveillance and police violence, you know, more so than mass incarceration, which has become, you know, too expensive, too cumbersome, too politically costly.
I think that's so important and significant, because what it does is it helps to, if you will, frame this change as part of a broader movement of not just profit accumulation, but actually population control. And one area that I think is particularly interesting about this that, you know, is worth exploring as well is the ways in which, you know, while workers are not always aware of it at the moment, and certainly people aren't always aware, there is a growing recognition that there's data labor, right? Every time they collect labor from data from us and are able to exploit it for profit, that's a potential employment relation and a point of, you know, need for labor control. So I think some of this policing is also preemptively dealing what could be, you know, a data proletariat who says, if you're going to, you know, use our data for money, then we have a right to some of that, or we have a right to control it, or we have a right to even own it. But I think this points to, in a sense, something you do very, very well in the book, which is really look at some of the political economy around these, you know, intelligent fusion industries. And the ways in which, ironically, empowering supposedly progressive discourses of decarceration have become not just a means of social regulation, as you spoke about, but themselves, you know, a really important new kind of capitalist opportunity and an opportunity for politicians to, you know, profit from it politically. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because I'm not sure. I think people are more aware of things like the weapons industry, et cetera, but, you know, to talk about this new kind of mass surveillance intelligence industry that's driving this, I think would be very important and interesting to know more about.
Right. Well, this is, you know, kind of in line with my comments about mass incarceration, you know, and not thinking about that as an economic project as much as a political one. We can say the same thing about the war on terror, right? A lot of the progressive critique of the war on terror is, you know, it's Islamophobic, it's, you know, it's racist, it's, you know, this clash of civilizations. But, you know, I guess there's the whole discourse, it's, you know, the wars were for oil, but I think the broader economic impact is often forgotten, right? So everyone remembers, you know, 9/11 in the US, that's, you know, has an outsized place in our political imaginaries and the narratives we tell. What is forgotten is the dot-com crash, right? So there was the cycle of busts that characterized the world economy in this period of long, long depression and stagnation that we're living in, you know, hit the U.S., you know, powerfully in year 2000, just before 9/11. Right? You know, $6.4 trillion in financial assets, 1.4 million jobs were lost, right? The downturn was resolved in part by launching another war of pacification, right? By launching the war on terror, by creating DHS. So between, you know, these two projects, between the war on terror and DHS, the United States spent $7.6 trillion in the decade following 9/11, right? So this was actually huge for the, you know, security industry. It led, you know, the creation of this huge counterterrorism, security apparatus, in domestic security apparatus, led, led to the creation of new firms. It led existing industries to reorient operations towards homeland security. You know, so a couple weeks ago, The Intercept had this big expose on, Microsoft and their role as a security firm, and a security firm not for, the DoD, and not for, not producing weapons, but producing intelligence platforms and surveillance technologies, mostly for police, right? The creation of Homeland Security was also kind of a, security Keynesianism to deal with the dot-com crisis, right? Mm-hmm. Then we have, 2008 and the Great Recession. Homeland Security budgets don't decrease, right? So you have this huge, we have an increasingly uncertain global economy, right? And you have this huge flow of public money in the name of security. So it led, to a reorientation of existing firms, and then, a rapid expansion of this, I think we should talk about it all in terms of a security industrial complex that includes, military surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. But, what happened with DHS is, the clear emergence of a, block of capital interests that are selling surveillance technology that are, that are linked to the, not only are they selling the technology, but they're actually linked to the, formation of the markets they're targeting. So, the fusions, all of DHS, and particularly the fusion centers that I studied, these are like a profoundly neoliberal project, right? They were created, there are no governing, there are no standard policies, hard and fast regulations that govern the fusion center, right? They operate in a, in a very loose framework of, baseline capabilities that were drafted in these large interagency working groups that very importantly include, police professional associations like the International Association of the Chiefs of Police, and now the National Fusion Center Association, right? So the National Fusion Center Association every year organizes these yearly conventions. Starting in 2003, they were done independent of the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice. So instead, technology firms co-sponsor these annual gatherings, right? So you have these big firms that, have developed their surveillance and data analytics platforms, places like IBM, Microsoft. You have ISRI, the GIS mapping firm. You have new upstarts in social media surveillance like Data Miner, excuse me. And all of these, businesses, not only are they selling surveillance technology, selling intelligence systems, they're also, working with the state, working with police professional associations to kind of shape the professional and regulatory market in which their products will operate. So all of this is happening, as prison populations decline. There's another parallel conversation that could be had about electronic monitoring. But these are growth industries that are creating a new, new patterns of administration, new material environments, right, where surveillance technology is everywhere, and it's linked into these intersecting, overlapping public-private police networks.
I mean, one aspect that I'd like to follow up on that a little bit is, and I think that it's really interesting these overlaps, which is how connected are they are to kind of national projects of state formation and building, and how much are they connected to kind of international industries that are a bit mercenary? And I know that this is a strange question in the sense that, like, you mentioned the international of associated police chiefs, and you've also though noticed like the national fusion centers, and this represents the ways in which a lot of these are very intersecting in terms of how much they are just technologies for sale and how much they are part of very specific imperial state building projects. So I was wondering if you had been able to look at that at all, or you can give some insight, because I think it's really significant to understand the ways in which this is both a global project of capitalist accumulation and a fairly traditional state-based project of imperial world building.
Well, I mean, I guess the thing that's important to keep in mind here is, the United States is still, the International Association of Chiefs of Police is, it's mostly, it's an international body, but it's mostly an American, it's American dominated. And really what it is, is a, it's a private, quote unquote, private entity. But it's a, it's a vessel for, the imperial world making projects of the United States. So if you read, say, Stuart Schrader's book, Badges Without Borders, which is about the kind of the way the history of counterinsurgency informed, police reform, police professionalization, police modernization, what you see in his work is the, the International Association of Chiefs of Police is everywhere. It's got its hands in, quote unquote, policy formation in the, in the United States, but it's also its members and the organization itself is involved in, police modernization in Cold War hotspots. So we see a similar thing happening, with DHS and with intelligence fusion, right? Like, the term fusion center was first used in by the Defense Department in the during the War on Terror. I trace the technique back further. I think the first domestic fusion center created in the U.S. was a counter drug intel center created by the DEA in the early 70s. But the point is that what we have, when you're studying security, the distinctions between domestic and international, between colonial and metropole break down, and you have a movement of people, technologies, practices, firms, capital, right, across these boundaries. It may not be represented in the official literature, but it's clearly understood, and it's shaping the development of these of these institutions. The other thing I would say is it's like important to recognize that, when you think of, this is a point on state theory, right? So in my book, I go back to the work of Niko Palantzis, who's this Greek Marxist, kind of best known for debating a British socialist, Miliband, on the nature of the state. And Palantzis's point about the state is that the state is isn't a thing that acts in a direct and simple way. It's not an actor, right? It's a condensation of struggle, right? It's the outcome of all these different politics of position taking to, define priorities and to, set goals. So when we think of something like intelligence fusion, it's not like, Microsoft and, a few big companies sat down with, the DOD, the Rumsfeld in, the head of the DOD in the George W. Bush administration and said, "We're going to sell intelligence fusion." And then they walked over to Homeland Security and said, "Let's do this too." I mean, what happened was, you know, it emerged slowly for, you know, for decades. At a certain point, this, you know, it became, you know, political opportunities were created, right? You had the United States looking to do this huge surge in security spending with DHS. And then what was lying around, what was available, who could take advantage, you know, eventually, you know, a consistent pattern emerges, you know, intelligence fusion or data fusion becomes an industry, a product that can be sold, right? You know, and it develops its own momentum. So I say that because, like, you know, like, I think this allows us to understand the relationship between, you know, different sites of struggle. Right, like when I was starting to do this work, I was really looking for my a document that said we modeled fusion centers all on the you know experience of counterinsurgency in Vietnam, you know, and I found things that were close, but I never found that document, right, and I never found something that showed that connection, you know, on a practical level was terribly strong. Right. And if we're looking at, say, the influence of these older, you know, from the, you know, these Cold War struggles on Homeland Security and the War on Terror and today's, you know, security apparatus, you know, the story is more complicated and meandering, and it moves from, you know, from domestic to international to, you know, different international sites. Right. But across it, you can trace, you know, a coherent movement of people, ideas, practices, you know, firms that gradually build up a knowledge base, that gradually build up a vocabulary, that gradually build up an expertise, you know, in products, right? And, you know, work towards a, you know, a general, you know, example that we can say, you know, call mass supervision. So that's the kind of the best answer I can give you to that big question.
No, I think it's perfect. I think that it's important also, like, for us to look at though the ways in which it's also been strategically opportunistic. And I thought this was one of the interesting points that you've made both in your book, but now I think more broadly, particularly in some more journalism pieces, which is, you know, you see this interesting trend, I think, that is not unique to the Trump era, but has certainly been exacerbated with the Trump era, which, you know, traditionally quite right-wing imperial institutions, such as the NSA and CIA, have very, very cannily used centrist and liberal politicians and liberal discourses in order to advance their agenda. I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, I mean, you know, the ways in which they've, I think, taken quite legitimate critiques of Putin and Russian oligarchy and imperialism, and use that to create a kind of very liberal red scare to support what, you know, many in the right wing call the deep state, right? And I see this now happening, and you've pointed this out so very well in terms of in an even more, you know, insidious and progressive level, if you will. The fact that these technologies are largely now going from kind of right-wing counterintelligence to very progressive desires for smart policing and community policing and decarceration. And I thought it was such an important intervention you made in which, you know, people were speaking right after the George Floyd murder about the ways in which we should use Camden, New Jersey as this example of how, you know, you can get rid of a police force, put in these kind of community tracking, smart policing technologies, defund the police, etc., and you can have a much more empowering, you know, form of community safety. And it was kind of like, you know, put to the side for MSNBC viewers the fact that no one in Black Lives Matter supported Camden. like that was kind of just forgotten. And I think that's also an important thing for maybe another discussion at another time about how actual activists and scholars are made invisible in these discourses. But nevertheless, you wrote such a powerful article that was actually saying, look, I want you to see how this is, you know, Camden is not an example of progressive empowerment or, you know, even emancipation, Rather, it's an example of mass supervision, and one that, pretty much is kind of, the 21st century version of what oligarchy is going to look like. So I thought it would be interesting, on two ways. For one, to give us a broader overview of how these discourses oftentimes go from things that are often much more easily understood and managed as kind of the right-wing counter-insur insurgency counter-terrorism discourses to ones that can very quickly and rapidly be repackaged as part of progressive reforms, and then how pilot projects like Camden actually show how insidious this actually is in practice.
Yeah, so I'm happy you brought this up, because the Camden story is an interesting one, and my book opens and closes with Camden because I think it's the trends that I'm writing about, I think they're expressed in the example of Camden, New Jersey, in the kind of most exaggerated fashion or the most fully developed fashion. So they kind of give us an image of maybe a warning of things to come. They give us it provides a look at the most extreme manifestations of the trends that I'm writing about. So Camden, New Jersey, it's the other side of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's a middling city, about 70,000 people. It's become a poster child of urban decay. It's a city that never, found its place in the information-based service economy, right? It's never recovered from deindustrialization. Before George Floyd, it became, and this gets exactly to your point, Peter, about liberal reappropriation of conservative discourse. Before George Floyd, when the United States was in revolt over, maybe the second wave of BLM protests around in 2014 and 15, around the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Barack Obama went to Camden. And he went to Camden to use the city as a prop to announce his, policing reforms to, this package of procedural reforms that he wanted to put forward to address the post-Ferguson crisis of police legitimacy in the United States. Right? What had happened in Camden in previous years is that, a particularly, I would say, corrupt and despicable Republican governor, this guy Chris Christie, came in and imposed austerity on Camden, said, the state of New Jersey is not going to pay for this city's excesses anymore. They imposed crushing austerity. They fired a third of the police department. Violence spiked terribly. Then, the local elites and the state government worked together to turn Camden into a laboratory of urban reconstruction and renewal. They, did these privatization schemes and urban renewal schemes. They privatized the schools, or they privatized part of the schools, brought in charter schools. They also disbanded the police department and relaunched a new non-union police force. And this new non-union police force, the public face of it was, oh, community policing. This is so nice and friendly, and we're going to go around and talk to people, and that's how we're going to solve crime. But lurking underneath community policing was, ubiquitous surveillance and aggressive intelligence gathering connected to, quality of life enforcement, broken windows policing. So Camden drove, after it had austerity in 2012, 2012, a terrible crime spike. The year after, by 2015, when Obama comes, they had, these massive and impressive reductions in crime. And Obama sold Camden as, as community policing, as a smarter, data-driven form of community policing. The political reality was, it was, a supercharged version of broken windows, right? Supercharged by aggressive intelligence and surveillance. The policing reforms themselves were connected to this larger, you know, project that had nothing to do with justice or dignity, right? It had to do with, you know, turning Camden into a market for capital investment, turning it from a burden on the state government as this, you know, place that the rest of the state was funding just to keep basic services going, to a, you know, to a source of revenue, right? To a place that firms would come and invest. So Obama, you know, this shows, you know, shows you all you need to know about President Obama's, about Barack Obama's politics, right? In the midst of, you know, a militant black insurgency demanding, you know, radical change, what does he do? He says, hey, let's have, you know, the media-friendly optics of community policing plus, you know, aggressive surveillance, you know, and we'll call that progress. So Camden was put forward as this model at the end of the Obama administration. Trump gets elected and kind of doubles down on this, you know, law and order populism. The Camden model kind of fades, but it's come back in a powerful way post George Floyd. And it's come back, you know, you're exactly right, Peter, you know, as the liberal answer. You know, Trump is doubling down on repression, but the liberals are trying to save the policing institution. And the way to do that is, you know, the model that they have readily available is Camden. So it's being, you know, it's being put forward right now. I think a dangerous thing is, you know, there's nothing about it that's incompatible with the tough law and order politics, you know. So, you know, I do think a Trump that was, you know, more politically savvy, more aware of himself, could have, you know, the next, you know, authoritarian, the next fascist that will come after Trump, you know, could very well package this model a little differently and put it forward as a solution, you know, as an answer to defund. And this is what's really dangerous, because defund the police is, you know, I think is the most radical, you know, radical demand to come out of the United States since, you know, in my lifetime, and probably since the, you know, the long 1960s. You know, it cuts to the, you know, the core of a lot of issues and could lead to some pretty significant structural change. There's a danger of that you know, a more savvy politician could say, yeah, sure, we'll defund the police, and roll that into a larger austerity project, reform, you know, turn defund the police into reimagine the police, you know, cut police budgets, you know, crush police unions, you know, which probably would be, you know, which would be a good thing given their pernicious role on, you know, in American politics. But that's neither here nor there, right? Because the goal of, you know, what the liberals want to do is not defund the police and abolish capitalist society and, you know, start meeting human needs. What they want to do is re-legitimize the police and, you know, do so in a way that might be leaner, more efficient, more conductive to, you know, to future, you know, the future needs of business in a, you know, in a capitalism that's has a worse and worse deal to offer people and needs to rely more and more on exclusion, right? So, you know, Camden provides a window into mass supervision because it's one of the, you know, few places in the United States where the vast majority of the population is structurally excluded, right? So there's pockets of Camden in every city. But, you know, there aren't many cities that, you know, almost 40% of the population lives below the poverty line, right? And Camden is one of those cities, right?
Mm. One of the things, though, that I think is... Oh, hold on. Wait, there's, again, a bit of a... Oh, there we go. One, two, three. No, I think that's, again, points to something that would be very interesting to explore a bit more if you're able, which is the fact that, well, for many commentators and scholars and activists, I think, you know, our we would definitely have a initial skepticism and critical lens to view this. One of the scary things that about this is that I think for many, many people, this doesn't sound so much scary as it does enabling. Like, oh, that's great. Like, I can, you know, track my and my neighbors and my community's activities more, right? So I'd be interested in terms of your, you know, research on this, particularly in a place like Camden, what this means actually when implemented on the ground, right? Because I think that there's a very powerful effect that people have when they hear about mass incarceration. Like the idea, like, you know, and I think the Innocent Project has worked on this very well in terms of, you know, making people understand what it feels like to be falsely imprisoned. Also, you know, abolitionists with the Defund the Police have, I think, done extraordinarily well about showing the affective means of living in a police state, essentially, or, you know, of having friends and family or yourself in jail. But I think that, you know, there still needs to be some work in terms of how we actually show on the ground, like what this means, how this isn't empowering, this isn't like a wonderful experience for people. So I was wondering, you know, because you've studied this in depth and you know the kind of experience and it is a pilot project, like, you know, going below the kind of large level analysis, what is it like in terms of like a kind of everyday experience of moving from mass incarceration to mass surveillance?
Well, with Camden, it's important to recognize that, you know, there's a few stages, or there's like, you know, there's an opening stage, and then, you know, and then the thing settled. So when the new reformed Camden County Police was created, they came out in force. You know, they came out very aggressive. They wanted to, you know, show the community that they were, you know, they were back. They wanted to drive crime down very quickly. They wanted to establish, you know, that they had a strategic plan to, you know, target a certain neighborhood of the city, push the drug markets out of there, you know. So they came in with force, and, you know, there was a lot of use of force complaints. There was a lot of, you know, citations written for minor offenses, and there was a lot of anger in the community. You know, then, you know, after that, community members, you know, led by the NAACP, led by the NAACP, went on, you know, organized and held leaders to account. Nothing fundamental changed, right? The Camden County Police still aggressively monitor every inch of sidewalk. It's still a hyper-policed city, but the police are a little less aggressive. They pump the brakes on broken windows, right? Mm. So what that means, if you talk to people in Camden, you'll get a lot of, you know, the Camden County Police are really bad, and let me tell you these stories about the first year or two, and then things have gotten a little bit better. They still can't, you know, people in Camden will recognize that the crime has dropped. You know, it's still unacceptably high, and there's many people saying that. There's many local leaders saying, you know, we don't need police, or we don't need, you know, we don't just need police. We also need, you know, investments in schools, investments in, you know, environmental cleanup, in all sorts of things. You know, but they do acknowledge the difference. And I think here, the dangerous thing about Camden, the reason why, like, Camden could become a model is because it does work to a certain extent, right? It, you know, in Camden, we haven't seen these super unruly, disruptive demonstrations. There's demonstrations. There's been Black Lives Matter actions in Camden, but, you know, they haven't escalated very far, right? The Camden County Police, you know, have this proactive community policing, you know, counterinsurgency approach. They're very proactive. They marched with, you know, protesters immediately, right? And that was that's a subtle way to try to co-opt not so subtle. That's an obvious way to try to co-opt, you know, dissent. But for a lot of police, that's a bridge too far and something they'll only do under duress or after violent oppression fails. So there's this on the ground. I talk to community leaders in Camden who say, the police are responsive. They'll actually return my phone calls. Like, we can get them to do things that are useful for us. There are some community leaders that are more pro-police. There are some that are more anti-police. Most of them recognize that, the policing remains an issue, and that policing can't solve all the problems it's set to solve. But the model itself is, it does accomplish something, right? And then you broader point, just to bring it back to the broader point, I think that we need to understand security not as protecting a natural state of affairs, but security is always a process of order making, right? So there's a difference between society, right? This equilibrium that comes together, right? This liberal dream of consensus and harmony, and then social order, right? Social order is, there's a winner and there's a loser, and it's a system of domination. So for some people, this security enhances their position. For other people, it deepens their subordination. Who are the people that are most adversely affected by the rise of the Camden County Police? It's the quote unquote surplus populations. It's the people, excluded from the formal economy. It's criminalized people, people with arrest records, people working in the drug economy. You have to understand, I mean, Camden has a huge drug market. It's a city with third generation drug dealers. It's a quarter of $1 billion of heroin reportedly moves through the city each year. So the groups that are, on the that are most victimized, that have the most to lose by this security offensive, also have no political power. They have no respectability, right? They're criminals, right? You don't even take them seriously, right? They're criminals, quote unquote, right? So what that means is that the resistance to, what's happening in Camden, I mean, some of it is channeled through BLM, right? But not much. And a lot of it just flies under the radar, doesn't register as political because it's a matter of crime. Meanwhile, the respectable people in Camden, like the people I talk to, community leaders, small business owners, people trying to hold their communities together, hold their neighborhoods together in a circumstance of, acute privation and, real violence, they have a difficult line to walk, right? They need to, maintain their legitimacy with, both, the police and the local political class, but then also with people in their neighborhoods. So, so they're operating in immense constraints. And, I don't think, what people said to me confidentially, privately in an anonymous, interview for an academic research project, is not the same thing as they're saying publicly in the newspaper or at public forums when they're, managing their frontward facing presentation to, the public in Camden. So yeah, I mean, if the Camden is surveillance city, there's a lot of criticism of it. There's some support of it. Some of the criticism is a lot of the criticism is suppressed, is illegible because it comes from, people who are criminalized and don't have, the respectability or political power to make their voices heard. And then, a lot of the local leaders who are sympathetic to those voices, are in a tight bind and have, a very narrow platform and, have to be very careful about how they, about the lines they try to walk.
I think, that really nicely provides a cohesive and really wonderful overview of these, issues. I think one of the kind of different parts of this is that we're right now in a situation where I think we do have to be critical of master supervision, as you've called it, and the technologies which support it, and the cultures that support it as well. However, I worry a little bit that this might distract, or if we're not careful, this might kind of elide broader discussions that we should be having about how this kind of tracking technology can actually be repurposed for more radical ends. I've written about the fact that there's a really strong paradox in our contemporary system in which, you know, everyday people are more monitored, but actually those in power are often less monitored. I mean, we oftentimes have so much less information about, you know, the flow of capital, about supply chains, about the ways in which power is being made and reproduced. And I'm wondering, in your view, I mean, do you think that, you know, during this time of abolitionism, where we're really trying to dismantle racial capitalism at its very roots, potentially, that this technology can be redesigned and radicalized for these more revolutionary ends of actually transforming and monitoring power, and then potentially being used to create a more cooperative and, I would say, mutually beneficial society that actually does care about human dignity and needs?
Right. I think this is a really important question, and I'm happy that we're talking about it in the context of the discussion we've been having, right? Because when we think about, you know, when we think about surveillance, we need to understand it's not just a matter of political control. It's not just, you know, it's a broader matter. It's of social regulation, right? So when we think about like your point about, you know, the disproportionality of surveillance, right? Everyday people, our lives are rendered legible to state and corporate powers, but we don't really know exactly how or to what ends, right? And then meanwhile, you know, elites and institutions are more opaque than ever, right? And we can't simply, you know, use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, to quote Audre Lorde. But, you know, what we can do, you know, to quote a line from her that people often forget, is that we can use those tools maybe for the defensive, to fend them off for a little bit. So, you know, I say this for two reasons. If we want to, you know, make our information societies work for the people and not for capitalists, then they need to be redesigned, right? The whole thing is premised on, you know, on the idea that, you know, your information, your personal identifying information, is a commodity that other people can buy and sell and do things with, right? So that needs to be contested on multiple levels, right? So we need to start talking about, you know, data sovereignty and data ownership in a digital commune, digital, you know, commons, right? You know, and that isn't just a legal and political intervention. It also, I think, would demand, you know, a redesign, you know, a redesign of, you know, of the technologies and the systems that we use, you know, that we use in our information society. So, you know, I don't, you know, it's kind of like this big, you know, this discussion of technology is kind of like the same discussion of the state, right? You need to, you know, you can't just seize hold of technology and use it as an instrument to remake the world, right? You can't just seize the state and use it to remake the world. What happened to the movements that took over the state? Well, the state became a prison and they became nicer prison guards, but we don't want to be nicer prison guards. We want to dismantle the prison, right? Mm. So that means thinking about technology differently. And it means thinking about, you know, technology beyond just resistance. How can we, you know, we can use cell phones to get, you know, to record the videos of police-involved killings, and we can hack police documents and leak them online, and we can, you know, use, you know, we can fight, you know, the cyber war of position, and, you know, take the political battles, you know, online in various ways, right? And that will get us far, but it won't get us far enough, right? Because, you know, when we talk about police abolition, right, I think a lot of people have a good idea of what that would mean, right? Police abolition would mean, you know, reducing the police, immediately, it would mean reducing the police down to an investigative body. It would mean beefing up other social policy responses to deal with forms of interpersonal harm and violence, right? So, you know, housing for the homeless, schools with wraparound services, you know, universal health care, and, you know, free walk-in clinics in every neighborhood, you know? You know, and it would also mean new community-based alternatives to deal with conflict, right? So all the examples of restorative justice, right? So we, you know, when people talk about police abolition, we have good ideas. When people talk about surveillance abolition, we don't, you know, we don't really get much further than the libertarian point, we should stop doing this, right? Yeah. And what we need to understand is surveillance isn't just about political control. It's about administrative rationality, administrative legibility. It's about, you know, surveillance is how a complex organization runs, right? And, you know, we live in a mass society with lots of complexity. I don't see how we can have, you know, any kind of social well-being without, you know, some form of efficient bureaucratic administration, right? So we need to be talking about, you know, what would a autonomous communal form of administrative legibility look like, right? Well, what would that mean? You know, and that's a question, you know, that's a question I struggle to articulate. It's a question that I'm not sure I can, I wonder how it lands with people, but I think it's a really important one, and I, you know, and I think it's one that, you know, we need to start having, or we'll end up, you know, we'll end up, you know, prisoners and COs in a diffuse everywhere, you know, digital prison.
I think that's such an important point, and it really gives us a lot of inspiration to develop these systems and develop these vocabularies for spreading them. And I really want to thank you so much, Brendan, for being on. I mean, another world is definitely possible, and you and your work is a huge part of that. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.